Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, we'll join a talk by Dr. James Marks, titled Healthcare, Health, and Economic Development, which took place recently at the Augusta Civic Center as part of the Maine Development Foundation's Policy Leaders Academy. Dr. Marks is Senior Vice President and Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Healthcare Group. This talk, as with all Speaking in Maine programs, will be archived on our website. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand to access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. If you wish to further support public broadcasting in Maine, you can purchase a copy of today's program by calling MPBN's Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717. I'll give that information again at the end of the program. Introducing the speaker is Dr. Wendy Wolfe, President and CEO of the Maine Health Access Foundation.
It's really a pleasure to welcome Jim. He is really a thought leader, a visionary, and an individual who both understands healthcare from being a physician himself, trained as a pediatrician, and also, by the way, has two physician children. So he obviously encouraged them to follow a path into medicine in his footsteps. He has really guided tremendous work on public policy to advance health and promote health generally throughout the United States when he served as director of the CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, and really trying to look at how we go beyond the provision of health care to make sure that each of us either preserves or achieves optimal health. Because in truth, this is really what we want out of our healthcare system. Nobody wants healthcare just to have go and see the doctor. We want healthcare so that we are healthier and that we enjoy health in our communities. And this is what Dr. Marks has really committed his life work to, both charting a leadership course and a vision on how we can attain this as a nation. I'm going to welcome him to the podium because he's going to speak to us today about healthcare, health, and economic development, something near and dear, I know, to your heart. So please welcome Dr. Marks.
Thank you, Wendy. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. I have to give thanks to the Maine Health Access Foundation, also the Maine Development Foundation. I've been impressed with the work that's been going on here. I also need to say, when I looked at where I was on the agenda, it reminded me a little bit when my family and I were hiking in Glacier. And we started out and we talked to the ranger, and he said, well, you know, there are bears in Glacier. If you see a bear, you need to look quickly behind you. And if you're between the bear and its food or its cubs, get out of the way. Well, I know I'm not between you and your food, but I might be between you or all that stands between you and your families. So I will try to keep my remarks relatively brief, but we'll have time for questions later. Wendy's told you about the foundation. The part of the foundation I work with is looking largely at health, not health care. We do a lot, actually, here in Maine about the quality of health care in our grant making. But my area is going to be about health, and I'm going to talk to you about it in that context. I'm going to touch on issues that you've already heard a little bit about this morning, and I'll try to tie those together with some of the directions I think we need to go. I learned a lot about Maine that I didn't know before I came. Maine is the oldest state, the highest proportion of the state with a population over 40. That health care costs were the number one issue for the businesses in the state. And that quality of life in Maine is one of the most attractive parts to Maine for attracting business and individuals to the state. Great things to build on. As you know, the information that I'm going to share will have a lot that's not good news. You've already heard some of that from the speakers. It's impossible to talk about the big picture and not talk about the economics of where we are. And very bluntly, we're in a period of economic challenge that could change the future of this nation. We need health reforms that are both intelligent and sweeping. The medical care system we have currently is failing us, and any statement to the contrary is no longer credible. I don't mean that regarding the quality of care people can get, but the overall way we're paying for it and what we're getting as far as our outcome. And as you know, it's becoming a big issue in our country's global economic competitiveness. It's also become a crucial issue for families as well. And I'm going to tell you a story. A friend of my son, the mother of my son's friend, had her own small business. She had health insurance, and she did for her employees. She got breast cancer. It was a difficult case. She was under treatment pretty extensively for several years. She capped out on the amount that her insurance would pay for. She, of course, had to then go into their family savings and remortgage their house and things like that. But because of her illness, she couldn't keep up the business, so the business failed. Fortunately, and I say that advisedly because, as you'll hear, she died. But she had a life insurance policy that enabled her to pay her bills and her husband to keep his house. That's the kind of system we have right now. This is not just about big policy issues. This is about families. Winston Churchill said, "You can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else." I think we're at a Churchill moment. We've tried many things. Now it's time to get it right. Now, I usually speak to medical or public health audiences, but when I was asked to come here, I was really excited. Because I think the solutions to our health problems will come from people like you and our legislatures even more than from within the healthcare professions. Public health and healthcare can tell us what causes a disease, how to prevent it or treat it, but leaders like yourselves will decide if those solutions are acted upon and how. So there are some hopeful elements in the talk that I'll share with you today, but whether that hope is realized will depend on what you do in your chambers here and what your counterparts do in other states. But first I'm going to give you a little bit of that big picture context. And where we are in our country in healthcare costs and where we stand relative to other countries that are our competitors in business and trade. We've heard from some of the speakers that, in fact, as you know, we are not competing town to town, state to state, but globally. And why? So that this is such a critical time and why we have to act with such urgency. I'm going to lay out why a shift to a better balance in our healthcare system and outside our healthcare system, too, towards prevention is crucial. One of the things that impressed me in my conversation with Wendy was that she said that many legislative members attend whose background is not in health or even whose committee assignments are not health-related. That's a real tribute to you and a strength for Maine, because I do believe that our healthcare cost problem is so serious that almost all the leaders in our nation will have to be thinking about how their work affects health and health costs, regardless of the committee they're on or their business interests. The link between our medical care costs and our economic development and future prosperity are that strong. That is, the improvement in health and our costs in the future will depend greatly on what the leaders in education or in agriculture or in transportation, in housing, in the private sector do to take health effects into account where they have authority, even if at first glance those leaders did not see their work as having all that much to do with health. But our leaders and the public in general have not been nearly as aware that how our society is organized, what our policies foster or inhibit, what our communities encourage and our institutions support are equally fundamental causes of good or ill health as are the biologic ones. Good health begins, is nurtured, protected, and preserved by how and where We live, learn, work, and play. Thus, many of the solutions that will help us the most with our diseases and medical care costs are beyond or outside medical care. And the problem of medical care costs and their impact on the economy, as you know, are more acute at the state level. You can't run deficits. I'm not going to talk much about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, depending on your point of view. I want to highlight only one aspect. The debate we had this time had one major element that was missing from the debate that occurred 15 years earlier when health reform was last considered on the national level. Last year, there was real discussion about prevention, and several elements that were important regarding prevention were included in the act. Early on, those prevention-oriented components got a lot of bipartisan support. But as the rhetoric became more heated and the various positions on the bill became more and more all or nothing, that support, much of it has evaporated. Unfortunately, there are several polls that show the public is having very high levels of support for an increased emphasis on prevention. And prevention not just in clinical care, but in the community as well. But regardless of how or if the Affordable Care Act turns out, we must act going forward. We can't just have a repeal or stoppage be the end of what we do in this area. All right. Some of this you've already seen. This is our healthcare spending in 2009, about $2.5 trillion, $8,000 per person per year. That's per person, not per family, not per worker. It's about 17.8% of our gross domestic product. In 1980, it was half as high a proportion of our gross domestic product. Medicare is the largest. That's the program for people over 65. It does not, as Wendy mentioned this morning, cover nursing home care. Nursing home care is heavily a state cost because many of the people that are in nursing homes are on Medicaid. So that part is one that you have to grapple with. Medicaid, just below there, total nationwide, $374 billion. The states pay about a third of that. The nursing home care costs and Medicaid in general are the fastest growing part of the state budgets, and it is where many of your fiscal concerns will play out. The state's share, as I said, of Medicaid is about a third of that $374 billion. But when you take into account that the state and local commitments for health insurance of their employees, like police, firemen, teachers, and other workers, the costs don't reach $4 billion a year. They reach $400 billion a year. So in addition to the Medicaid costs, there are the costs for the people who live in Maine that are employed by Maine. So if Maine's like other states and your costs for Medicaid and health insurance for state employees, they're probably running $1 to $2 billion a year and growing rapidly. Now let's move to some bigger picture economics. There's been a lot of talk about the federal deficit. In 2007, our public debt in aggregate was about $12 trillion. And of course, after 2007, the recession happened, and our deficit has grown very rapidly with the use of federal deficit spending to help reverse the recession and fix the banking system. It's going up $1 to $2 trillion per year. But there are areas of public commitments and debt to pay out where that are not often given the same attention as our public debt. Naturally, the major area that people are aware of is Social Security, the commitments made to older Americans and working-age Americans regarding their future retirement. That's another $7 trillion. But only recently have people started to notice how much we've committed to our citizens in Medicare. Medicare alone, $34 trillion, dwarfing the rest of the federal debt and Social Security combined. So you can see why we have to get serious about our medical costs and why delay is so damaging. And it is so large that we are unlikely to solve this by tinkering around the edges of our financing. So you can also see why I think nearly every future important law and policy issue in the states or at the federal level, and probably in individual communities too, will need to be looked at to assess its effects on disease, injury, or improving health. Will any new law or policy lower illness and injury rates and help with health care costs, or raise the likelihood of persons becoming ill or injured and further increase our costs? Europe has been doing this for the last several years, looking at the health effects of their major policy decisions in agriculture or transportation or housing or manufacture. We have not. What are the three main things that raise healthcare costs over time? General inflation, pretty straightforward, the increase in the consumer price index. Medical care inflation. Over the last several decades, there has been extra inflation in medical costs over and above normal consumer inflation. This extra inflation has been even larger than the growth in our economy. That's why the percent of medical care that it consumes of our gross domestic product has risen so much that it's doubled in the last 30 years. Much of this increase is due to improvements in medical technology that are more expensive than the old technology, things like new drugs, diagnostic tests, equipment, etc. Care has gotten more intensive and more expensive for the same conditions. The third is aging. Healthcare in general costs more per year for older adults than younger ones. And I'm going to talk about this a little more because it's also a central issue for us as a nation. And as I found out in coming here, it's got to be even a higher priority issue to think about for Maine. On January 1, 2011, the first of the baby boomers turned 65. And by 2030, when all of them will have turned 65, the percent of our population that is over 65 will have doubled. All of the struggle to grapple with the growing health care costs as a nation so far have occurred on the relatively flat part of that curve. Think of what it's going to be like in the future. And of course, we can't change how fast people get older. This is how serious the effect of aging is on health care costs. Relative costs by age. Just so that you know, the average costs occur between 45 and 49 years of age, the age that the youngest of the baby boomers are now. And the highest costs are near the older ages, as approach 80. At the oldest ages, the costs average roughly 400% what they are at 45 to 49. And the number of people requiring long-term care, not included here, will also increase greatly. So even though Medicare, the insurance for older adults, comes under the federal budget, Medicaid, the program where the states pay a lot of the costs, is what covers nursing home care. With an aging population, that burden will grow rapidly for both the federal government and for the states. The combination of rapidly increasing costs with age and the large numbers of persons entering the most expensive age categories drives our urgency. This is the curve that we might be able to change. How much does it cost at individual ages? Now, like they say in the TV infomercials, but wait, there's more. There are even more reasons why we need substantial change and urgently. What I haven't described is that we are already far behind our competitors in costs and health and losing ground rapidly. Other countries are simply getting healthier faster than we are, as measured by their life expectancy and infant mortality, among others. And their health costs are rising more slowly than ours, and they provide insurance for essentially everyone. Let's look. The U.S. currently spends about 2.5 times what other countries, our principal competitors, spend on health care. In 2007, we spent a little over $7,000 then. The average was about $3,000. Canada spending about $4,000 at that time. In 1960, the U.S. and Canada spent about the same per person per year. So since 1960, we've diverged. And of course, our emerging competitors like China and India spend much less than these countries. They don't even make the chart of the most expensive countries for health care. In 2007, we spent almost $4,000 more per person, not per employee, but per person in the nation. So if you were going to start a new company, wouldn't you think twice about going to a place with that big a handicap in your costs right from the beginning? Now, there have been several analyses that try to say, how do we differ? There are lots of things that differ, but I will tell you the largest part of that difference in a single place is in administrative costs. The estimates are we spend about $500 billion more per year in our administrative costs than do other countries. Now, there's one issue that I didn't mention earlier as a cause of increasing medical costs, because it rarely comes up in the discussions by policy leaders. But if the amount of costly diseases is increasing, it will drive up our costs just by itself, even if everything else were staying the same. And if it were higher here in the U.S. and increasing faster here than in other countries, it's especially serious for us in our versus our economic competitors. So let's look at one example. Persons requiring admission for diabetes complications in the U.S. were much higher than other countries. You all know diabetes is costly as an illness. Each of these hospitalizations costs thousands of dollars. And in the estimates were in 2000 that roughly one-third of the children born that year would develop diabetes in their lifetime. What's the principal cause of diabetes? Well, like night follows day, diabetes follows obesity and inactivity. So you know that obesity rates in the U.S. have skyrocketed over the last three decades. The increase in adult obesity in the U.S. is even greater than other countries. Rates are going up everywhere, but they're higher and going up faster here. According to the CDC, the average adult in the U.S. now weighs 24 pounds more than he or she did in 1960. Now, I said that this is about increasing in adults. The increase in obesity in our children has been over twice as fast as it has been among our adults. So the average 10-year-old in 2000 weighs 11 pounds more than the average 10-year-old did just in 1990. Scary for the amount of future disease we will need to treat and pay for unless we can turn it around. But that's why some researchers think that this today's children are in danger of becoming the first generation in our country to live sicker and die younger than their parents. And healthcare finance researchers believe we cannot sustain the health coverage we have now, as troubled as it is, unless we can lower the amount of disease we have, especially disease related to obesity. So let's quickly recap. Our health costs are increasing very rapidly. Healthcare costs are the biggest part of our unfunded commitments. Those that are, you heard this morning, that are too poor to afford health insurance are charged the most. Other countries spend less, are healthier, and insure almost everyone. Our current system even puts people with insurance at risk of bankruptcy. And we have more disease than elsewhere. And who are the most likely to be uninsured in our society? Working age adults. It's hard to imagine how we could have done worse. What can we do? It's going to take a lot of substantial changes. But I believe that the most underutilized one, the one that we haven't tried, is to do what we can to have less disease that we have to take care of and to pay for than we have now. Can we prevent disease, or at the very least delay its onset in seriousness to much older ages? This is not just prevention within medical care, which you heard in the Affordable Care Act has gotten attention. There were other elements in that act about helping communities transform themselves to be healthier places. But what can we do beyond medical care, I think, is crucial, and why I was so pleased to speak with you, where so many of the members who don't even have health as a central part of their committee attend. Now, I want to be clear as I discuss prevention with you. It is not the only thing that'll be needed. We will need still to do a lot of work around medical care financing and coverage and efficiency. But prevention is the thing we haven't tried yet, as Churchill would say. And it offers a lot of opportunity, and a lot of that opportunity is going to be at the state or community level. As researchers and health policy people are saying, we have a sick care system, not a health care system. We pay for repairing our health after illness and damage has occurred. So the questions that are usually asked about prevention are, could it really help, and could it, we do it at a price that gives us good value for the dollar spent? And then, if the answer is yes, you will have to decide what can we do to make the incentives work so that people, families, and older adults do the right things and so that the private sector and the public sector can have incentives to do what they can to make it happen. So first, could prevention make a big enough difference? I'm going to use just a few examples. This slide is from a study that says, what's the likelihood that a man age 50 will develop diabetes, heart disease, or stroke by age 65? Well, if he's active, normal weight, and doesn't smoke, the chance is 11%. If he's a smoker, obese, and inactive, the chance is 58%, over a 500% difference. If we had a drug that good, we'd put it in the water. There are similar numbers for women. Shifted a little bit. Women live longer, so shifted to a little bit older ages, but generally the same direction. I want to be clear on a couple of things. What I just talked about, not smoking, being active, maintaining one's weight, you're not hearing the new Nobel Prize idea here. This is what we've known, but we haven't implemented as well as we could by far as a country. Let's look at another study. This is headline is from USA Today. This was a study, though, that took people who were pre-diabetic. Their sugar metabolism was starting to deteriorate, but they were not yet diabetic. Some were given a drug to see if the progression to full-blown diabetes could be slowed or even prevented. Some were given moderately intensive counseling about changing their lifestyle and losing weight, becoming more active. The study had to be stopped early, before it was even concluded, because the lifestyle arm was so much more effective than the drug, over twice as effective. Over a 50% reduction in the likelihood of becoming diabetic over 5 years. How big a lifestyle change was needed? People on average that were on that arm lost 10 to 15 pounds and started walking 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Real changes, but not huge. And they led to really big changes in diabetes. Now, most people with health insurance would have that drug paid for. None would have had that kind of counseling paid for until just recently. This past year, the YMCA showed that its staff could do just as well as medical care system counselors in getting people to make those lifestyle changes and slowing their rate of progression to diabetes. And United Healthcare, a large medical insurer, has said it will reimburse the Y for doing that counseling. This is the first time ever that United Healthcare has agreed to reimburse a non-medical provider for a service. Now, these are two fairly specific prevention examples. I've tried to keep them linked to my earlier comparison of this country with others regarding diabetes and obesity. But I could have just as easily used other examples of where prevention that's really important but was outside the medical care system. Seat belts, airbags are important examples. Workplace wellness programs have been shown to save companies money in health care costs. Or tobacco, smoke-free indoor air laws like you have here in Maine, and you were one of the first states to do it. But study after study has shown that reductions in heart attack rates occur almost immediately after the enactment of smoke-free indoor air laws. There are many more. Now, the question that's always asked about prevention is, does it save money? Is it cost-effective? Do we get good value for the dollar spent? I'm going to digress very briefly and say we almost never ask that question of medical care, and we're going to have to start. Even some things that work in medical care may be very costly for the health improvement we get. And that can be a big part of the medical care inflation that's been so much greater than general consumer inflation. Now, some prevention actually does save money. More is a good value, that it's cheaper than having to pay for the disease. But not all of it does. I'm not going to talk about any specific diseases, but I'm going to use this study that looked at the lifetime health care costs of individuals who made it to age 70 very healthy without any real disability. Those with any health limitation from a little bit to a lot, regular comparison. Now, those who get to 70 without any limitation lived on average 14 years longer, and their health care costs in this $136,000 were lower than those who had some limitation. Those who had any kind of limitation lived only 11 years longer, and their costs were $145,000. So total health care costs is about $9,000 less over an entire lifetime. Nice, not huge, but nice. But when you look at it at the year, at per the cost per year of life remaining, the difference is quite large. It's about a third less per year. So the person who makes it to 70, still pretty healthy, does have a longer, more gradual slope of their health care costs with a total that's lower than it would have been, even though they live longer. So that one that I said we really could grapple with, here's evidence that it would work if we could keep people healthier. There's been another study, separate from this one, that shows that those who don't smoke, maintain their weight, and stay active, delay limitations in their health an average of 7 to 10 years. Again, nothing new in that, but how much we foster and help people make those changes. Now I'm going to talk about another report. Another question that prevention, that's asked about prevention is, would it provide good value quickly enough? This report from the Trust for America's Health and the Urban Institute looked at preventive actions that were shown to be effective and estimated their cost effectiveness within 5 years. They found that a package of interventions that cost about $10 per person per year would break even in saving in health care costs in 2 years, and it would save over $5 per person for every dollar spent within 5 years, and the savings would go up after that. The interventions largely dealt with the issues we've just discussed, increasing activity, improving nutrition, and preventing smoking or quitting. The total savings from this modest investment was about $16 billion, with over half being saved by the private sector, the next largest by Medicare, and then by Medicaid. These are savings only in medical costs and don't add in the savings in productivity. For Maine, in this report, they estimated the annual dollars saved at about $98 million per year. Wall Street Journal is starting to get it. And if you can read this, you can't read this, it says, you can't be serious. Exercise would completely destroy my way of life. So prevention can lead to big improvements, and often reasonably cheaply. Healthy older people live longer and still cost less and substantially less per year. And so prevention can be a good value and in a reasonable amount of time. The achievement of science is to convert fate into a societal choice. But it's societal policy and action that determines the ultimate impact and value of that science. If our societal forces are not in alignment, new scientific advances stall. It's research that turns disease and injury from fate's misfortune or bad luck or accident into biologic understanding and potential control. But that research then turns its understanding over to society, to leaders like you, and it's the policies you decide on and what happens in our communities that transform understanding into impact on disease. And that is especially true in how much disease or injury is prevented. Thus, the policies and the laws become part of the chain related to the amount of disease or injury we have as a nation. And the laws and policies are where the biologic and the societal and the political forces affecting health converge. To reach all people in need requires that companies and organizations that are right in the middle of where and how we live, learn, work, and play take on health as one of their considerations. Many of the kinds of actions that I mentioned during this talk are not really the responsibility of the public health agency or the medical care system, though they're important. So I hope you can see why I believe leaders like you in all parts of our society look at what they can do to help improve our health, especially by doing things that can prevent or greatly delay disease. At its core, public policy is the way a society frames what it wishes to become. The public is starting to get the importance of prevention. They're more supportive of prevention than ever before. Across political affiliation and demographic group, whether it's for smoke-free air or tobacco tax policies, particularly when people know the link between those policies and the benefits to their children or their families. And they get it about that some of these interventions are going to be about schools and communities. Now, before I close, I'm going to return to the issue of a community's health and its economic development by telling you a couple of stories. Not too long ago, I had dinner with a business school professor from North Carolina who said he's seeing that industry, when it wants to move to an area to build a plant or expand, is now asking, how high is the obesity rate for the area it's considering? They view obesity as a proxy for future health care costs and productivity. And if the obesity rates are too high, they stop looking and don't move there and look elsewhere. He also talked about BMW, the car company. About 20 to 25 years ago, South Carolina got BMW to build a big plant there in competition with other states, as you might expect. The state gave them tax breaks. They built an exit off the expressway right to their plant just for them. The business professor said BMW had no idea that South Carolina was the center of the stroke belt and that their health care costs would be so high. And now it's scrambling to get others in the private sector to work together with them to see what they can do to improve the health in that area of the state because of the high health care costs and disability among its workers. Let me give you another example, this time from Indiana. I heard Mitch Daniels, the Republican governor there, speak. He's the former CEO of Eli Lilly, and he was the former OMB director, Office of Management and Budget Director, under President Bush just a few years ago. So he knows his way around the budget and the bottom line. In his talk, he said that his major job was to bring jobs to Indiana, and he had a great story to tell. Geographically, they're located within a day's drive of most of the U.S. population. Their people are better educated than average in the U.S. Their housing is cheaper than average in the U.S., but their health care costs are higher. Now, he doesn't tell this to companies that are looking there, but he knows the smart ones know it. So he asked his legislature to raise taxes on cigarettes and devoted the money to improving health. He rebuilt the state tobacco control program. He expanded insurance for the working poor, where he set it up so that the first $500 was available as first dollar coverage for preventive services, and only if the person had done all that was appropriate for their age could any of that money that was left over be used to cover regular medical costs. And he became the poster child for becoming physically active. He wanted his state to get ahead of others. Now, it's important to recognize that as long as we have a health insurance system that is heavily employer-based, and because health care is among the largest costs for employers, it's highly reasonable for a company to want to lower or control those costs. And so companies are recognizing that the population's health, where they locate, affects their bottom line. This means it is increasingly to a state or a community's economic advantage to make itself a healthier place to live. We're at a watershed time in our nation's history. We have to be honest with ourselves as a nation. Technologic advancement, where our nation's leadership is unquestioned, has failed to rein in medical care costs. Nor has it even given us better health relative to other countries of similar wealth and development, according to standard big picture measures like life expectancy. In fact, even as we have increased our medical care spending by over $1 trillion per year in the last decade, we've gone down in ranking relative to other countries. The fact is that the likelihood of initially becoming ill or suffering an injury is really about whether one smokes, what and how much a person eats, whether one's active, the safety of a neighborhood, the toxins or microbes and conditions where people are exposed to where they live. This all must lead us to conclude that the major health problems of our society and time will not be able to be solved by the clinical care system. What we really need as a society isn't more expensive treatment. What we really need is less disease. In fact, without less disease, we are finding we cannot afford to provide the good treatment that the medical science have developed for those who do become ill or injured. So even our nation's hope for good quality medical care for all those needing it is being put at risk by the excessive amount of disease we have to manage. As a nation, we're going to have to think differently and look elsewhere for potential solutions. And I hope you can see why I think we have to look to prevention and all it entails within and beyond medical care, and why the actions you take here in Maine will be crucial to how Maine does and how our nation does in the future. Thank you.
Please identify yourself, if you wouldn't mind, please.
Representative Jane Knapp. And we are a global society, and I have a limited experience with Australia. In one of your charts, you talked about administrative costs, and I was wondering if malpractice insurance was built into that, because a lot of other countries have tort reform, so they don't have the malpractice cost. Thank you.
It's not in those administrative costs. That is an issue that we spend more, and it's a little unclear how much more. We spend more, obviously, in the settlements and the suits, but the question is always asked regarding defensive medicine. Very hard to measure, but it's not in those administrative costs and that excess that I mentioned.
My name is Seth Berry, and I'm a representative from Bodenham. Thank you for your presentation. We have a grant that came through the Affordable Care Act for $10.5 million. Specifically for home visitation, and we have some home visitation efforts right now that we fund through the Fund for Healthy Maine. It's tobacco money, and the goal is to expand our home visitation programs where perinatal families, before and after birth, especially at-risk families, get a visit, whether it's a trained nurse or some other trained individual who can help the families to give the infant an early start and a healthy start. Can you talk about any work that you know of in the foundation world or the policy world relating to that, and give us any advice on spending that money if we do continue to have it?
The best studied example of the home visiting for young mothers is the Nurse Family Partnership. It's had randomized trials, the kind of studies used for cancer drugs, showed spectacular improvements. Nurses visit the homes of young mothers for the first 2 years in life, and they stop after that. They help them understand what's reasonable for their kids, how to manage their kids. The mothers do better. It cuts child abuse rates by 50%. But what's more spectacular is the kids, nothing happens after age two, do better in school. So they go further in school. They're less likely to be involved with the juvenile justice system. So there have been analyses that have suggested out of Washington and the RAND that it's these later things that are so valuable, so that it ends up saving money. It is struggled because it's costly at its beginning, but in the long term, it saves several dollars per dollar spent. There are variations on that, but the nurse family partnership is the one that's been the most well evaluated. We were the ones, our foundation paid for much of that randomized trial work. There have been three trials: Elmira, New York, Memphis, and Colorado. And we've followed the first group of children up until their early 20s. What's spectacular about this, or depends on your point of view, actually, is that Congressional Budget Office would never have scored this as a valuable program because the greatest benefits occur beyond 10 years. Congressional Budget Office can only score for 10 years. OMB would never have scored this as a valuable program because the savings that occur, the most important savings, occur in juvenile justice, but not in the health budget where the actual intervention comes from. So we've got biases within our nation that make really sound investments less likely to be supported. That I know of that program because we had joined with other funders a few years ago to say, what could we do to get it to reach 100,000 young women? And then it got included in the budget. And so I hope Maine uses it really well.
Mike Finnegan, I work for a nonprofit community development financial institution, and your comments about preventative care are very relevant, and I think it's a varied landscape as to what employers are doing to date. But as we reflect in some of the areas that we finance, renewable energy, affordable housing, there's been a great success story in terms of bringing tax credit policy to these areas to generate the kind of housing, affordable housing outcomes we want. Now in renewable energy, you have a 30% tax credit, which translates into millions of dollars being made available to projects. Is there some way you can take this preventative health care goal, turn it into some sort of maybe employer tax credit that would basically inspire the company to do good things around improving the overall health of its employees in a real transparent way that demonstrates real outcomes and real improvements in their overall health, which would translate into a reduction in healthcare costs in terms of their insured population within the company?
Great question. I'm going to answer it several ways. First of all, if you don't know, Pennsylvania looked at getting supermarkets back into their inner cities in the what they called the food desert areas. It wasn't tax credits, but they gave below market financing, and they had groups help to put together often the land that might be needed to be aggregated for a supermarket. They put up $30 million as a state. They got over $80 million of private sector financing. They have 100-plus supermarkets being built. I visited one in inner city Philadelphia. It was the fastest to profitability of any in that chain. They had no difference in pilferage rates, all the kinds of things you might ask. They had to have some things done. They had to have some zoning things done. They had to arrange for the bus to stop in front of that market so that people that didn't have cars, they could figure out the number of jobs that it would keep or provide in that inner city. So it became a big development success in Pennsylvania. Several other places are doing it now. They're doing it in Newark, New Jersey. They're doing it in New York, Illinois, Louisiana. And if you've heard about the Healthy Fresh Food Financing Initiative at the federal level, it's to pick up on that. So that's one. The other is we had a commission look at how to build a healthier America, where we said we wanted them to look at things that were beyond medical care. We had people from private sector. We had Republicans and Democrats. So we had Walmart. We had Bill Frist. We had a woman who heads an equity not-for-profit on the West Coast. We had a great variety. Well, this excited the Federal Reserve. You may know this. So in their community investment journal 2 years ago in December, they had all about what community investment, often in housing, could do to help in health. They've done it again this past December. Last year, the national conference was on this. This year, it'll again be on community investment of the type that you're talking about and its improvements in health. That's the kind of thing that's starting to happen in Europe, where they're looking at broad policies and saying, how can that be be set up to improve health. So in the investments that the community development organizations like yours can do, you can have small parks. You can add sidewalks. You can have a charter school. You can have a supermarket. They're more apt to do it now that they think they can figure out how much value that brings in health. So the kinds of things you're talking about, I think, are going to be increasingly important. The broad approach of tax credits or below-market financing that you raised, I think, is a very good one and one that we haven't deployed enough, but it's more apt to be deployed in these other sectors. But those other sectors are really important for health. So, as you know, the various funds that can affect community development are actually about $30 to $40 billion a year. That's a lot of money. And working together, we think we can figure out how much health benefit and how to maximize the health benefit for those developments without really changing costs too much. So I really appreciate you both being in the audience and asking the question.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dr. James Marks, Senior Vice President and Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Healthcare Group, and a speech he gave recently at the Augusta Civic Center on speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can find it online at mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. To further support public broadcasting in Maine, you can also purchase a copy of today's program. To do so, call MPBN's audience services at 1-800-884-1717. Again, to purchase a copy of today's Speaking in Maine program featuring Dr. James Marks, call MPBN Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.